new political phenomenon without comparing it with classical fascism. It's something transitional between fascism and something unknown, which is emerging. Well, there is a debate in
the
United
States. We just have 20 seconds. I hate to say to you, Professor, we just have 20 seconds.
Yeah, so I said I have no difficulties to depict Trump as a fascist. He proved that he is ready to transgress the basic features of democracy, contesting the outcome of the election. But this kind of fascism is not a meteor.
We have to leave it there, but we are looking forward to doing an extended interview when you come to New York City. Cornell professor Enzo Traverso is author of the new book, Gaza Faces History. And that does it for today's show. We've been broadcasting here in Denver at the studios of PBS 12 at the Five Points Media Center, which is also home to Free Speech TV. Thanks to the folks here at PBS 12, Bobby Springer, Mary Latsis, and the whole crew. Next week, we'll be broadcasting from Baku, Azerbaijan, the UN Climate Summit. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, the first case of Oregon bird flu has been confirmed today.
Zenith Energy's permit from DEQ has been put on hold.
And labor union LIUNA will begin offering 12 weeks of paid maternity leave to its members.
Good evening. This is KABU Evening News for Friday, November 15th, 2024. I'm Hannah Francis.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, just confirmed the first case of bird flu in Oregon today. The Oregon Health Authority says there is no evidence of person-to-person transmission and the risk to the public is low. The human contraction was from a previously reported outbreak at a commercial poultry operation in Clackamas County. Sarah Present, the Clackamas County Public Health Officer, said the individual experienced mild illness and is fully recovered. They were treated with oseltamivir, an antiviral medication. People who came into contact with the individual were prescribed a similar medication. This version of bird flu, type A H5N1, has been spreading widely in the U.S. among wild animals like birds, poultry, and cows. 50 cases have been reported in humans this year in California, Washington, Colorado, Michigan, Texas, Missouri, and now Oregon. All but one person had been in contact with infected animals. People who have had close or prolonged exposures to infected animals are at higher risk of infection. Dean Seidlinger, a health officer and state epidemiologist at OHA, says using personal protective equipment like gloves and masks will help reduce infection. OHA also recommends avoiding contact with sick animals and to not consume raw or unpasteurized dairy products.
St. Helens School District announced that St. Helens High School Principal Katie Wagner was put on administrative leave and Board Chair Ryan Scholl resigned from his position today. Students and parents put on protests for the past 2 days calling for the removal of Superintendent Scott Stockwell, Wagner, and all board members for failure to report years of sexual abuse. The choir teacher, Eric Stearns, and a retired math teacher, Mark Collins, were arrested earlier this week. Stearns faces many counts of sex abuse involving 6 different students. The indictment states that his pattern of sexual abuse against students began in 2015. Collins also faces many counts of sex abuse involving 3 different students over a 6-year period. Another case of sexual abuse in St. Helens High School began almost 20 years ago with teacher and coach Kyle Robolewski. He was arrested in 2019, and the district agreed to pay $3.5 million to an unnamed student who he abused. It was one of the largest settlements ever paid by an Oregon school district. Several in the St. Helens community alleged school officials knew of the allegations against these teachers and failed to act. St. Helens acting police chief Joseph Hoag said his department subpoenaed the district in October and found historical reports against these teachers. The school district must inform law enforcement about these reports, but never did. Hoag said, quote, "There were multiple historical reports made to high school administration from 2019 to 2023, and this also corroborated the victim statements that detectives had previously received," end quote. Columbia County District Attorney Joshua Pond said his office is investigating whether the district broke any laws by not forwarding the reports to law enforcement. The school board will discuss possibly placing the superintendent on administrative leave in a meeting this afternoon.
Budget in a little extra time if you plan to use TriMet in downtown Portland this weekend. Service will be disrupted on blue and red lines with some traffic around Southwest Morrison between 11th and 12th Avenue. Crews will be closing a 100-foot section of the MAX system while making rail improvements in these areas on Saturday and Sunday. No rails will completely close during this time, but there will be disruption. Riders will board a shuttle bus at the Galleria Southwest 10th Avenue and Providence Park MAX station to get around the construction. The shuttle buses will come through every 5 minutes or so. TriMet said riders should budget in an extra 15 minutes into their trips in downtown Portland Saturday and Sunday.
The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality has put a pause on issuing Zenith Energy a new air quality permit. And the government agency says environmental advocates are partly to thank for drawing attention to the issue. Withholding this permit won't immediately stop Zenith, but it could stop the energy terminal from sizing up, stop their future ability to operate this terminal, and, at a minimum, could force Zenith to confront the issues that DEQ raises. Zenith Energy transports fossil fuels on trains through the city of Portland. It's risky business. At any point, they could explode, burning houses and polluting the area with toxic chemicals. Local climate justice organization 350PDX has dubbed the vulnerable neighborhoods the quote-unquote blast zone. The storage facility for these fossil fuels is on the Columbia River. And environmental advocates and a neighborhood organizations have serious concerns about the structural safety of the containers and the potential disasters in the event of an earthquake, with natural gas exploding on the city and leaking into the river. DEQ found Zenith had already done more expansion than they had permits for. At this point, it's unclear to what extent DEQ is cracking down on Zenith, but local environmental advocates are pleasantly surprised by the change. Until now, attempts to warn the city government of the dangers that Zenith Energy presents in Portland have been met with little reception. Deneen Crow, campaign manager for 350 PDX, said, quote, This really shows our community engagement and grassroots organizing really works, and it's powerful. DEQ says more information will be released by December 6th.
Boeing machinists in Oregon and Washington returned to work November 6th, ending the 54-day strike after winning huge contract gains. The new agreement will raise wages 43.65% over the next 4 years, ending the scope of the agreement in 2028. It raises pay by 13% off the bat. The union rejected two contracts offered by Boeing, settling on an agreement that is close to the original union proposal of 40% in 3 years. Some of the demands that were met include a $12,000 ratification bonus, boosted starting pay from $12 an hour to $21, reinstated annual bonuses, reduced mandatory overtime, and parental leave, among tens of other wins. Boeing machinists did not get everything they hoped for. For instance, they did not get the pension that they wanted. They also did not get board positions for union members. Nonetheless, this was the first contract renegotiation in 16 years, and union members feel it was largely a success. The president of Oregon-based District W24, Brandon Bryant, said, quote, "Everybody did their part. We could not have done what we did without each and every one of them. It's just a shining example of what a union is really about," end quote.
Labor union LIUNA will offer 12 weeks of maternity leave starting next year. The Laborers International Union of North America, otherwise known as LIUNA, will begin offering 12 weeks of maternity leave benefits starting January 1, 2025. Mothers will be eligible for up to $800 a week for 12 weeks. Federal law currently protects 12 weeks of unpaid medical leave, and certain states have paid leave that may include childcare in places like Oregon and Washington. In Canada, federal maternity leave policy is up to 15 weeks for new mothers. Their standard of paid leave is a little over half of the employee's income, up to 668 Canadian per week. The European Union requires their countries to offer a minimum of 14 weeks paid maternity leave, with 2 weeks being mandatory. Women currently account for one-fifth of LIUNA's workforce. Local 737's business manager Zach Culver says that the hope is the maternity leave will encourage more women to join the union and that it will support women remaining in the workforce if and when they have a baby.
House Republicans are trying to push a bill through the Senate that would give Trump the power to top down halt nonprofits. With dozens of Democrats still supporting the bill, there is plenty of breathing room for the Republican majority House to pass the bill on a second try. The Stop Terror Financing and Tax Penalties on American Hostages Act would allow the Secretary of Treasury to revoke a nonprofit's tax-exempt status by branding it with a terrorism label. The House did not grant the bill the necessary two-thirds majority in order to move on to the Senate. However, the House Rules Committee is planning to hold a hearing that could set up a new vote on the bill. The bill was originally proposed to combat protests against Israel's war on Gaza. The bill would threaten First Amendment rights to free speech, and there are now fears that the president-elect Trump could use these powers to crack down on his enemies. Kia Hamadanchi, senior policy counsel for the ACLU, said in a statement, quote, "The freedom to dissent without fear of government retribution is a vital part of any well-functioning democracy. And now is not the time to grant the executive branch new powers to investigate and functionally shut down and silence its critics," end quote.
Matt Gaetz's nomination raises ethical concerns. Trump's health pick fuels vaccine disinformation worries, a minimum wage boost gains support, California nonprofits mobilize, and an election betting CEO gets raided by FBI. With more on the story, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Trump was not shy about what he wanted to do, and Matt Gaetz knows exactly what to do with the Attorney General's office. He will turn that in to be most powerful Attorney General in American history.
Florida Democratic Representative Jared Moskowitz worked with controversial Attorney General pick Matt Gaetz, who he describes as both fiercely loyal to President-elect Donald Trump and fiercely competent. The House Ethics Committee was preparing to release a report on sexual misconduct, misuse of campaign funds, and illegal gift allegations against Gaetz. He resigned from Congress Wednesday, ending that investigation, and a similar criminal probe closed without charges. But his nomination to be the nation's top legal official is likely to face sharp opposition in a closely divided Senate. Trump has nominated anti-vaccine activist Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to be Secretary of Health and Human Services. That's drawing intense criticism from senior medical officials. CDC Director Mandy Cohen warns against disinformation about vaccines and eroding public trust.
We have a very short memory of what it is like to hold a child who has been paralyzed with polio, or to comfort a mom who's lost their kid from measles. I don't want to have to see us go backwards in order to remind ourselves that vaccines work.
Voters in five states approve minimum wage hikes. That includes Missouri, where it'll go up to $15 per hour and then rise with inflation. Richard Von Glahn of Missourians for Healthy Families says minimum wage increases have been proven to help businesses by reducing turnover.
Having guardrails around the economy makes sense for everybody. It's what allows our community's values to be expressed. Policies like this actually can save them money because it reduces turnover.
The FBI has seized electronic devices from ahead of an election betting website, which faces scrutiny over anonymous cryptocurrency wagers. Polymarket CEO Shane Coplin has not been charged with a crime. He says the raid of his New York apartment was politically motivated after the site predicted Trump's win.
We feel vindication with Polymarket being right, and now in hindsight being actually the most accurate way to follow the election. It's a novel concept and people were skeptical when it came around, but hopefully now people will be a lot more embracing of market-based information.
With the Republican Party now controlling the presidency and Congress, the trifecta gives Trump significant authority to pursue his agenda on the economy, immigration, and other key issues. A state alliance of nonprofits called We Are California says they are mobilizing against possible Trump policies that impact immigrants, LGBTQ plus communities, and civil rights. Angelica Salas is with the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights.
Mass deportations, family separation, worksite raids. These are all things that he has done in the past. But what we're expecting is a scale of attack on our community that is unprecedented.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, it's Once Upon a Time. Tonight's weather is cold and cloudy with a low of 41 degrees. Tomorrow's weather is also cold and rainy with a high of 47 degrees. Today in history, it's gaming time! Microsoft releases the Xbox gaming console in 2001. Halo, the military science fiction video game, is the most popular game played on the console with around 16 iterations and sequels. The quote of the day is from Japanese video game designer and game director at Nintendo, Shigeru Miyamoto. He encouraged us to relish and play and joy, saying, quote, "Video games are bad for you? That's what they said about rock and roll," end quote.
The National Park Service held a recent symposium on the cultural impacts on tribes by the 1924 establishment of Wapatki National Monument. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The National Park Service held a recent symposium on the cultural impacts on tribes by the 1924 establishment of Wupatki National Monument in Arizona. KNAU's Richard Davis has more.
Central to the day was a panel to elevate Indigenous perspectives, Wupatki's federal management. The panelists recognized efforts by the Park Service to incorporate tribal history and asked for better representation in administrative roles and increased education on Wupatki's true history. Stuart Kuyumptiwa, Hopi Cultural Preservation Office Director, took issue with the very creation of the monument and the perception of Hitsatsinom structures as ruins.
Wupatki, as it is known today, we have never waived our right to that place. We still call that our home. It's not abandoned, as archaeologists, anthropologists, and even the Park Service may think. We still have deep connections to that area.
Navajo Nation Historic Preservation Officer Richard Begay condemned regulations that hinder religious practices.
We have to have permission from Park Service to access our sacred sites to collect plants. If that plant only grows on Wupatki, if it is restricted, then the knowledge of those plants and the rituals associated could easily be lost.
Park Service staff recognize the impact the management of Wupatki has had on Indigenous people. Amy Horn, Cultural Resources Program Manager for Flagstaff Area National Monuments, said,
"It's a painful part of our monument's history. We want to acknowledge it and make sure that they are heard so that we can have a collaborative relationship in the future."
The monument's official 100-year anniversary is December 9th. I'm Richard Davis.
The Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage is known for its exhibits and cultural programs, but as KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, the center's Indigenous awareness programs are growing in popularity, especially during Native American Heritage Month.
Good morning.
Almost 700 students filled the auditorium at East Anchorage High School this month to learn about Alaska's many different Native cultures and their values. Students gave the team from the Alaska Native Heritage Center a warm reception for two separate programs this month.
We do a lot of amazing stuff. It fills my cup.
Chris Delgado manages the Heritage Center's cultural awareness programs, which are offered not just at schools, but to a variety of organizations.
We have National Park Service. We're working with the FBI. We are working with the United States Air Force.
Maureen Cronin, an academics coach at East High, is not surprised that companies want to invest in programs that raise their employees' cultural awareness. She says cultural literacy is important everywhere, but especially at East, which has students from 50 different cultures and is one of the most diverse schools in the nation.
It's really important to demystify cultural generalities, and it's important to develop cultural understanding.
And cultural appreciation for what the Heritage Center calls the genius of Indigenous culture, or indigeneity.
That's how we survived out in the Arctic back in the day.
Colton Paul, a six-time gold medalist at the Arctic Winter Games, who demonstrates traditional Alaska Native games at the workshops, says the athletes and their feats of strength and endurance epitomize indigeneity.
They can jump so high, they can kick way above their heads.
One of the things trainers at the Heritage Center say that they've noticed is that when people gather together to learn about another culture, they also learn to build better relationships with each other. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
I'm Dr. Anthony.
A native plant project fights to protect Hawaiian Punalu Beach and Road from rising sea levels. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The road connecting the communities of northern Oahu in Hawaii passes by Punalu'u Beach, a narrow public park. But sea level rise and other threats are increasing erosion at Punalu'u Beach, putting both the park and the road at risk.
This is an area that, again, is connected by one road in, one road out. And if we lose the road there, then we'll lose that community as well.
Leia Laramie is with Hawaii's State Climate Commission. The state has been studying some long-term options for protecting Punalu'u Beach, including adding sand to the beach. But the community wanted to take immediate action, too. So in March, volunteers helped plant native plants in the beach's sand dunes. Laramie says these plants help prevent erosion by stabilizing the beach while still allowing for the slow, natural movement of sand.
We were hoping to get, you know, like 20 odd people, but we ended up getting 75 volunteers, which was just so amazing to see so many people come out and care for the space there.
Laramie says since then, residents have continued to weed and water the new plants, helping to protect their beach, road, and communities from erosion as sea levels rise. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
A new study out of Ohio offers new hope for lymphedema care, including a way to monitor their chronic condition remotely. Farah Siddiqui has the details.
Ohio is leading the way in new research that may help those affected by lymphedema. It's a chronic condition that causes painful swelling due to buildup of fluid in the lymphatic system, which is part of a person's immune system. For many patients, this condition can develop following cancer treatment. Teresa Lau, a breast cancer survivor and lymphedema patient at the Ohio State University James Cancer Center, describes how new monitoring technology has provided her peace of mind.
This is great for somebody who lives an hour away from OSU. It lets you know, it's like, my arm swell up and so what can I do? What are the next steps?
The study Teresa refers to, called Project Limb Rescue, uses wearable technology to monitor lymphedema in real time. Ohioans with this condition can participate by visiting OSU for a brief session where they wear sensors that measure fluid buildup. The program aims to help patients detect swelling sooner, potentially reducing complications. Lymphedema affects about 4 in 10 breast cancer survivors. Lynn Brophy, an oncology nurse and study coordinator, notes the benefits of the program for patients across Ohio.
Our research study is to help people developing lymphedema detect it at home. It means they're saving money by not having as many physician visits.
Brophy adds research leads to new discoveries, and she encourages people to join the trial.
So I hope people will be open to participating and helping either themselves, perhaps, or their neighbor.
OSU researchers are recruiting participants between ages 18 and 90 who have undergone lymph node removal surgery. For Ohio News Connection, I'm Farah Siddiqui.
The cost of food is a major focal point in the U.S. New research seeks to highlight how higher wages open families' access to healthier foods, like resulting in better health outcomes. Groups working in Nebraska to fight income inequality see hope while expressing caution. Mike Moen reports.
If state and local governments want healthier populations, new findings suggest they should be more aggressive in tackling income inequality. A Nebraska organization feels that approach is on point. A new study from Johns Hopkins University looked at obesity levels in more than 3,000 counties across the country. The places with minimum wages of at least $9 an hour had greater success in reducing obesity rates. Christine Carey helps address economic justice with the group Stand In for Nebraska. She says other data routinely show that healthier foods tend to cost more, so the connection made in this new research is pretty clear.
Raising the minimum wage is obviously a way to increase access to healthier food. You just have more money to spend on it.
In 2022, Nebraska voters approved a gradual increase in the state's minimum wage, which is set to reach $15 an hour in 2026. At the same time, the state doesn't fare well in obesity rankings. Carey sees a chance for numbers to improve as wages go up, but she notes not all communities have stores that sell healthy foods, potentially hindering that progress. The study's authors also call for place-based interventions like urban farming initiatives and subsidies for healthy food retailers to go along with higher wages. Carey says that's an important step in tackling this issue.
It's pretty well known among geographers that we shop at the closest place, meaning don't expect people who are already low income to seek these things out.
She says creating more awareness and options in underserved communities can help maximize the impact of higher wages from a public health standpoint. Carey says that's especially important in a rural state like Nebraska, which has seen its food, retail, and health facility options disappear in smaller towns and cities. This is Mike Moen for Nebraska News Connection.
Virtual power plants create microgrids by connecting residential rooftop solar and battery storage to smart appliances such as heat pumps, electric vehicles, and water heaters. Communities in rural Colorado are pioneering energy independence using clean and affordable electricity. Eric Galatas has more on the story.
An electric cooperative that supplies power to Western Colorado is pioneering energy independence for homes, businesses, and farms. They're creating a virtual power plant, a network connecting residential rooftop solar and battery storage to smart appliances such as heat pumps, electric vehicles, and water heaters. Lisa Reed with Holy Cross Energy says this microgrid can be tapped to keep the lights on when power lines from coal and gas-fired plants are disrupted.
Holy Cross Energy is implementing the use of virtual power plants to help with resilience, both for large events such as wildfires, but also for smaller events to keep our power reliable.
Holy Cross is standing up virtual power plants, or VPPs, by providing affordable home battery storage lease-to-own options to members who subscribe to their Power Plus program. These batteries store energy when demand is low and supply power during peak times or outages. Virtual power plants also reduce reliance on costly, polluting energy from coal and gas-fired units. Tyler McDermott with the Western Colorado Alliance says VPPs are also important for national security. If a hacker wants to take out a power grid, they can target a single conventional power plant, but it's much harder to knock out a decentralized grid that extends across entire communities. Microgrids also cost ratepayers 40 to 60% less than building coal or gas powered plants.
We all want to pay less for our energy. We all want our lights to turn on when we flip the switch. We want our ACs to work in the hot summers. Virtual power plants are the answer to one of the biggest problems that we're facing all across the nation, but especially in rural communities.
Reed says networked residential and business batteries also help community members save money on their electric bills in the middle of the day when energy from conventional power plants is the most expensive.
Holy Cross Energy discharges those batteries onto the grid to reduce our peak load, thus saving money for our members in power supply costs.
This is Eric Galatas for the Colorado News Connection.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 15th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Hannah Francis, Althea Billings, and Eliza Yurkov. The producer is the beneficent Hannah Francis.